Okay, thank you very much. Thank you, everybody, for coming. It's Perimeter is a great place to be, actually. So the talk is about precision physics in storage rings. This is not quite a tabletop experiment, but it's a mini storage ring, maybe a room size, a big room size storage ring. But then I'll tell you about the proton electric dipole moment and the Newton electric dipole moment. Those require larger storage rings. And those precision physics storage rings can tell us a lot about new physics and old physics, this so-called standard model. And since we are at it, I'd like to add some information about the axion dark matter experiments we do in Korea. And we believe there is dark matter in Korea as well. And we are probing it. We are giving it, actually, a good run. And very soon we'll have very good results, very interesting results. So the storage rings, I'll talk about the mu g minus 2. This experiment, even though it's an old story for a lot of you, you heard about it, there is, it's coming online again, so it's very interesting. And I can tell you a couple of the new things we do in Korea to actually reduce the systematic errors on that. And also to talk about the proton and deuteron electric dipole moment experiments. On the other side, the axion dark matter experiments, those of course are very interesting. And finally, it looks like we are going to reach the theoretical levels, the hadronic axion levels, when we assume 100% of the dark matter to be axions, but also to go beyond that level. And for that, we use the workhorse for that is to go into high field magnets and to be able to probe high volume, to use high volume geometries. Where are we? We are in the middle of South. We are safe, thank you very much. Between Beijing and Shanghai and Osaka, and what do? We really probe the strong CP problem. This is the symmetry crisis in strong interactions. The hadronic EDM experimental limits are too small, even though the theory predicts them to be not so small. On the cosmic frontier with the dark matter axions, axions are so feebly interacting with matter that you really need to, in order to make a big progress, you really need to make improvements in all the possible parameters. And we've taken this approach. Then the storage ring proton EDM, where we claim we can develop the most sensitive hadronic EDM experiment. And by the way, doing that, improve on theta QCD sensitivity by 3 to 4 orders of magnitude. The people who are sensitive to this kind of physics, they really appreciate that because the improvement is linear with the sensitivity improvement on the electric dipole moment. And this is Andy's talk from yesterday. I won't say much about it. I'll only give you one slide on this. Together with a long-range monopont dipole axion-mediated forces experiment, that's the Ariadne, probe axion physics in a unique way. That is, we can finally probe axion physics. You know, there is no way to prove that the axion physics is real, is actually a choice of nature. But we, between combining the Ariadne and the proton electric dipole moment, we can make a definite statement about that physics. What do? In Korea, we mainly work on axion dark matter. that is we have developed called TASC, that is CAPP, that's the Center for Axiom Precision Physics Research. CAPP, Ultra Low Temperature Axiom Search in Korea. Then collaborate with Ariadne and GNOME. GNOME is about axion balls that just go over the Earth. And also work on the μNG minus 2 experiment at Fermilab on systematic error reduction. I'll tell you a lot about the μNG minus 2 in this talk and the systematic error reduction we are working on. And the proton electric dipole moment development for an experiment at CERN, which is taken very seriously and is going on very well so far. Magnetic dipole moments. All right, if you have a particle with mass and charge E, and it's rotating, then you have an angular momentum that's given by this equation, MVR, a magnetic dipole moment equals the current times the area of that circle. And then you get a magnetic dipole moment that is proportional to the angular momentum times E over 2m. This is for a classical system. Now, if you go into a particle with intrinsic angular momentum, then you'll get, in addition, the factor G. All right? And this turns out to be, for leptons, about 2, not 1 as in the classical systems. So in a magnetic field, there is a torque, mu cross B. You apply a magnetic field, you suddenly get a precession. All right, the definition of G factor, you can think of it as the magnetic moment in units of EH bar over 2m divided by the angular momentum in units of H bar. All right, and the difference really measures the charge and mass, the difference between the charge and mass distributions, and it is equal to zero when they are the same all the time. And this is why it is very important to measure G minus 2, because you measure quantum field fluctuations. And from Dirac equation, point-like particles, so that doesn't take into account the quantum field fluctuations, you get G equals exactly 2. This is for point-like spin 1/2 particles, like leptons, the electron, the muon, so on. Why is this important? Well, NMR, nuclear magnetic resonance, was discovered by, this is Rabi, and in 38 already, and of course now we use it in MRI. We don't call it NMR anymore because of the nuclear word. And it is the same technique, it's just we look for the precession, and we can have very clear images of the brains and without having to open the skull. This is an amazing technique, all right? And it became available after developing, of course, this technique, but you also need a tremendous amount of data handling. You had to have computers to make this available, and that's when this became available. But you can also do another thing with magnetic dipole moments. You can probe quantum field fluctuations. It's really a soup of virtual particles that come in and out of existence, and it interacts with a magnetic dipole moment of particles in the B fields. And then this interaction is estimated using Feynman diagrams, and it's expressed by the anomaly. The anomaly is the A equals G minus 2 over 2. This is it's called the G minus 2 experiment. G factors. You go to the proton. You know, when the experimentalist first tried to say, he was trying to put together this experiment, the theorist told him, you're wasting your time, G equals exactly 2, don't do it. He did it anyway, and the number he found was 5.5 something. It's hardly equal to 2, all right? It was that back then, they knew that the proton is not an elementary particle. The neutron was found to be negative 3.8, And it was the first indication, of course, they are both composite particles. Their ratio, being up close to 1.5, minus 1.5, was the first success of the constituent quark model. So we learned a lot about the structure of nature by looking at the spins, right, and the G factors.
Bob Hofstadter at Stanford, using the linear accelerator, he investigated proton interior structure. And then it was not a point particle, so they didn't know about quark, but he got a Nobel Prize for that. So is this G measurement done before?
Well before.
Well before.
20 years or so.
Oh, okay.
Yes. 30. Thank you. And the G minus 2 of the electron, look at this. This is an amazing system. I'll show you in the next slide as well. That is non-zero mainly due to quantum field fluctuations. Experimentally, I used to say we don't have sensitivity to forces other than QED. But that's not true anymore. We've seen the first day yesterday a slide where we started being sensitive to the hadronic correction over there as well. A super virtual particles coming in and out of existence involving only QED, mainly QED, I should say. Okay? And the magnetic dipole moment of leptons can be estimated with high accuracy. This is an amazing measurement. This is absolutely an amazing measurement. We saw this this slide yesterday, very similar, but it is really this is half a centimeter size. This is the scale of this. Of course, it has to be in cryogenic temperatures and so on. And it's really a triumph of QED. But it also it tells you QED is good to the 10th order. Look at this. This is it tells us that we know how to estimate QED with high accuracy. But why do the mu and G minus 2 experiment then? The reason for that is that every particle, that is the muon being heavier than the electron in this ratio of 200, square of that is 40,000. So it's you create a thicker soup of virtual particles that come in and out of existence, and that helps you probe heavier particles. All right? And by the way, the muons are sensitive to Ws and Zs. All right? In your physics, it could be neutralino if they exist. And the Ws and Zs are 1,000 times heavier than the muon, and yet the muon produces them, and it's an amazing concept, right? If you wrote a book about it, nobody would believe you. This is, you go along, and sometimes you became a 1,000 times heavier. It's an interesting concept. But this happens in nature all the time. Okay, muons, the standard model. We have the leptons, electrons, muon, taus, and the corresponding neutrinos. Those are the three families. We have the electroweak gauge bosons and the quarks. And, of course, the Higgs was discovered in
July 4th,
it was announced, yes. Yes, now it's 5 years, it's still recent, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yes. Right. I'm telling you about the muon, that's the second family, second generation of particle. All right. And the muon decays, the decay is self-analyzing. By that, what do you mean? The highest energy electrons from the muons carry information about the muon spin because it goes along the spin direction of the muon. And that is an extremely important parameter in trying to find the G minus 2 frequency. Okay, so these are the summary of the magnetic dipole moment. You have this, you have a little bit of a magnet, and And remember, the decay electron goes prefers to go along the spin direction of the muon in the rest frame of the particle. You have the Dirac and Pauli moment, the anomaly, okay? And of course, QED predicts A and so on, and all of the theory parts. And now you have the theory. This is this the G factor being equal to, that's the first term. The second order, you have a photon, a muon goes along, and then it emits a photon. It interacts with a magnetic field, and then it gets reabsorbs the photon back, and so on. In the meantime, it interacts with the magnetic field, being a different muon. Now you can create an E plus E minus, and so on. It's a beautiful story. And QED can be estimated extremely accurately to very high order. And we know these parameters, even we know from the electron G minus 2, that this has been, these parameters are known to very high accuracy. But there is that's not the whole story. A mu, the first order, is alpha over 2 pi, is 1 over 800. Just this effect is actually the same for the electron and for the muons. It's exactly the same. Okay, this is mass independent, but that's it. That's it. But the rest become mass dependent. All right, you have the standard model contributions. This is the vacuum polarization. This is the hadronic vacuum polarization. And then you have the W's and the Z's. All right, you see this one looks like this photon. It's very similar. All right, now you see over here a muon becomes a W. The W interacts with the magnetic field, and then it reabsorbs the neutrino and becomes a muon again. And this is becoming a particle 1,000 times heavier. All right, of course this process is virtual. Okay, how do you do this experiment? We've done this experiment at Brookhaven National Lab, and now we are starting again 2017. The way you do it is you take protons from an accelerator. This was at the AGS of Brookhaven, and Fermilab is a different accelerator. Then you hit a target, and you produce lots of pions. Those pions decay into a weak decay. You produce muons. And by looking at the specific momentum of the muons, you can get them polarized. Very near 100%. It's actually 94% polarization you can get of this muon beam. The reason for that is because neutrinos are nearly massless. Not exactly, now we know that's not exactly zero, but it's nearly massless. And they come into one with one helicity. They are left-handed. So if you look at a certain momentum, only the forward-going muons, you can get them to be completely polarized because you know the neutrinos are completely polarized the other way. Now you have a completely naturally polarized beam, a longitudinally polarized beam that you can inject into a storage ring. And as the particles go in there, the spin starts precessing a little faster than the momentum. That's the G minus 2, because we look at the difference between the momentum and the spin precession. Many times people are confused about that. We don't look at the spin precession in absolute terms, we look at the difference between the momentum and the spin. So for every turn, the spin gets ahead of the momentum by about 12 degrees. All right? Now look at this. There is a subtle point of over here about magnetic dipole moments and electric dipole moments, and makes this experiment actually possible to do. At rest, the spin precession is mu cross B. That's the magnetic dipole moment, only couples to the magnetic fields. and then the electric dipole moment only couples the electric fields. Now, if you notice, there is a large asymmetry in this because mu is relatively large, but D is compatible with zero. How many particles are known with electric dipole moment? Fundamental particles, okay? It's compatible with zero at this point, or for all of them. There is none, not a single one, all right? And what happens is this: you get this DSTT mu cross B at rest. Forget about the electric dipole moment for a moment. Then you have a magnetic field in the vertical direction, and the spins are aligned at the beginning. Then the spin gets a little bit ahead of the momentum. All right. And then you look at the difference between the spin and the cyclotron frequency, and you find it to be independent of velocity. This is a miracle. Now, if this precession dependent on the velocity, it would be impossible to tell, to measure this, the anomaly to fraction of parts per million. Just impossible, because you can measure velocities, distribution of velocity. You cannot control them to very high, to that high accuracy. So this is an amazing qualification, why it makes this experiment possible. Okay, it's independent of velocity. Now, in order to have high accuracy, you want to measure this to a fraction of a part per million. You need to measure the G minus 2 frequency to a part per million. Therefore, you need to know the magnetic field to a part per million. And if you have an inhomogeneous magnetic field, you cannot know it to part per million. It's very hard. You would need to measure the position of the mu into microns. Microns in a storage ring of 15 meters diameter would be hard to do. So, but there is one thing you can do. Instead of magnetic focusing, you can use electric focusing. And this is the second miracle that happens for this experiment, makes that possible. Look at this. If you have a low momentum, a low energy particle, then the spin hardly moves. That's because, remember what we said? The spin doesn't couple to the electric dipole moment, all right? But if the particle is ultra-relativistic, the electric field looks like a magnetic field. And so it acts on the magnetic dipole moment. You get it, the spin gets ahead of the momentum, just like in a magnetic field. That means you can adjust the momentum of the particle to get it just right. And that is called the magic momentum. And it's 3 GeV over C for the muon, and a gamma of 29.3. That's why we use for the Brookhaven experiment that kind of a ring, a momentum of 3 GeV particles. All right, and we use electric focusing. That's the reason we do this experiment at 3 GeV over C. Okay, now if you want to put equation on this, this is omega A, this is AB, and then there is a complicated formula that is the magnetic field depending on the momentum, whether or not which way it goes up or down. At the magic momentum, this disappears. This idea was developed actually at CERN, okay? And now it was used at Brookhaven and now at Fermilab. And it's really, the momentum is the mass over the square root of A, or G for the proton, all right? That's the idea over here. So this is what we do. We use an electrostatic quadrupole for vertical focusing. That's the magic momentum, 3.09 on average. And you get a pure measurement. Just the electric field is really a small correction because you cannot make a pencil-like beam. There's a very small correction because you have some momentum dispersion. So you have some momentum muons that have different momentum than the magic. Okay, So this is the experimental technique. You get the protons, pions, the decay. That's parity-violating decay, and then you get another parity-violating, and so on, to infer the muon spin. This is in order to store the particles. You see how you inject the particles over there, and then you have a perfect circle, so it would hit the inflector again. Therefore, you need a very fast kicker to change the particle direction, the angle, and to be able to store them. That's the reason you have the fast kicker. It's about 100 nanosecond pulse. You need to create about 300 Gauss, and these 300 Gauss have to disappear below 15 milligauss by the time you start taking data. Okay, and then that's how it looks.
How many muons do you have in the beam?
Per injection, you get you store something like 10,000 muons, 10,000 out of teraprotons. I mean, the efficiency is very, very low, right? Mm-hmm. It's but you get 15 hertz, and then every second at Fermilab. So we have to have we hope to have something like 20. About 23 billion particles.
Total for the nanometer.
That's right. Depends on the statistical sensitivity. Now it's 4 billion for the Brookhaven, and we said 20 times that statistics. It's 100 billion for the Fermilab experiment. Yeah. All right. The electrostatic quadruples look like that. There are four places around the ring, and they provide the vertical focusing. The horizontal focusing, of course, is given by the magnetic field itself. And you have a lot of calorimeters sitting over there waiting for the electrons to hit them, and then we measure energy and time. Okay? That's the cross section. These are the coils, the outside coils. These provide the magnetic field here, 1.5 Tesla. And the beam goes into a very narrow channel. I mean, the geometry is really amazing. In order to keep the magnetic field very, in this confined place, very homogeneous, you have to have a very narrow channel. That's all you can do, because there, you exclude the main magnetic field, the 1.5 Tesla, and you can't do much better than this. So this is about 1.8 centimeters channels. You have to channel everybody through that, and then to get them into the storage region. And that creates some complications, and those complications create potential systematic errors. And we, in Korea, we are developing a system to correct those complications, and I'll show you a little bit later on that. What we do now, this is the top view of a vacuum chamber. As the muons go along, it decays into electrons. The electrons go preferentially in the rest frame along the muon spin direction. And so if the spin and the momentum are aligned, then you have the highest energy particles in the lab frame. And that's what we do. We have a calorimeter there that detects those. All right? So this is what you see. This is from the experiment itself. At the top of the peak, this is oscillation. If you look at the energy spectrum at the peak, you see this one. And if you look at the bottom of the oscillation, you see this spectrum, all right? And if you put an energy threshold offline, you can do that, 2 GeV, for example, you see the number gets modulated. The asymmetry you get is an amazing. For 2 GeV, you get 40% asymmetry. That is in the amplitude of the sine wave you are looking at, all right? This is the storage ring at Brookhaven. And we are going to improve the sensitivity by a factor of 4 at Fermilab. And this is what we get. This must be the most beautiful sine wave in nature. It's beautiful. There is no second harmonic on it. It doesn't depend on the acceptance of the detector. All right? This is a quantum mechanical effect. So it's independent of the acceptance of the detector, as I said, unless the particle moves. So, and I'll show you a couple of things that are the complications. Now, over here, we get, you see the number of particles per 150 nanoseconds. And you see over here, there are 10 to the 7, 10 million per bin. And in red, you have the point, the number. And in blue, you have the error bar. The error bar doesn't show until very, very late. It's a beautiful, beautiful statistic. So, I mean, this of course, is wrapped around, all right? This would go, it would be a very long slide that way if we didn't wrap it around. Statistics, sub-PPM accuracy, and statistics limited. So that's why we want to do this experiment again. This is the magnetic field. It's the cross-section from the Brookhaven one. Now, the Fermilab has been, G-2 magnet, has been shimmed to better than this by a factor of 2 already. So it's already better. All right? From the Brookhaven experiment, we get two numbers. We get the theory. This is that part. And then the experiment, you see this. All right? And they differ. They differ by about 3.5 sigma, and we don't know what it is. It could be a number of things. It could be dark photons. It could be supersymmetric particles. By the way, a lot of people say supersymmetry is dead and so on. I think it's too early to call it dead. Okay? This nature is a lot smarter than we are, and there are different ways to circumvent us, so it may be at a little higher scale, that's all. So what a muon goes along and then it goes into a neutralino here and this muon and then it gets back together. This neutralino, by the way, could be the dark matter as well of a WIMP of the universe. We have sensitivity to this particle. And that's that. In the sensitivity, the muon anomalous magnetic moment, this anomaly, it's sensitive to these SUSY particles more than the W and Z would be depending on the tan beta parameter. All right, and then you create this, of course, supersymmetry, an image of every particle has, it's a fermion, it has a boson counterpart and so on. And this could be the dark matter. All right, so we wanted to do this experiment again. And I thought this would never happen. I mean, myself, it was an impossible thing. 15-meter coil to put it on the streets and then put it together again and just survive and work. And it's an amazing thing, right? From Brookhaven National Lab, we took it all the way around. And this is all water, all of it. After maybe 20 kilometers. It's an incredible thing.
Can you connect that with water?
Well, the Mississippi. It was there. Thank God it was there already. But not only that, we had a choice. We had a choice to go from the top to this end. We had two choices. And it just the timing just happened that it was more... safer to go that way. It was slightly cheaper to go that way, actually. That was it. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Right. It arrived at Fermilab. Fermilab, well, the weather was getting angry, I guess. This is not a Photoshop.
I was there when it arrived, and it was incredible. I mean, the sky was just like that.
Oh, yeah. And a lot of people showed up for it. I mean, free beer probably helped. It's a great feast. Right. Now, at Fermilab, the goal is to achieve 0.14 parts per million, 20 times the statistics, reduce the cycle time from 3 to 1 seconds and so on, and then longer beam line, get rid of the backgrounds and so on, and better matching of beam line with ring phase space, reduce the CBO, All right, this part, the last part, we were advertising it, but it didn't quite happen that way. So Korea, our students here, are working to save the experiment from that. This is a new place. It's beautiful. I mean, the whole building. We at Brookhaven, we had a really old building from the 60s, the old bubble chamber experiment. Here, they built us a new building. This is an amazing change. This is the ring. It's, again, this is in the new place. Beautiful. It's powered up at 1.45 Tesla, and we know this number to very high accuracy. Yeah. And it's us over there while it was built. And this is data. This data, absolutely, everything worked. It's from the engineering run. So, and now in the fall, we are gearing up to take real data, and the excitement is building up. All right, this is a big international collaboration, 8 countries, 33 institutions.
The sensitivity that you have is the 3.5 simultaneity to 5?
By 1 year time, it will. Okay. But the analysis, of course, this is the data. We'll have the data to match the Brookhaven experiment number in 3 to 4 months. So we should, but I don't know how long it's going to take to analyze that data. All right? But we are all eager to see the number, absolutely. Absolutely. This is us. This is Shanghai. This is us in Korea. Daejeon. Okay, now let me tell you a little bit about the systematic errors, all right, at Brookhaven and at Fermilab. This is at Brookhaven, and this is what we project them to be at Fermilab. You see gain changes, so this thing actually has been done very well, and I believe this will happen. PyLab has to do with intensity and so on, but we are using now segmented calorimeters, and probably for the same rate, it would be the same. But for higher rate, it will be the same as in Brookhaven, as a matter of fact. And then we have lost muons and coherent bedatron oscillations and electric field and the pitch correction, the fact that the muons don't go a little bit along the magnetic field as well, oscillate up and down. All right? And this part is not so trivial. So this is what we are working on in Korea. We project this to be better, but we'll make it happen, we believe.
What does that mean, lost muons?
Muons are stored.
Yeah.
They are stored in a linear system, but there is always something that the field is not exactly homogeneous.
Yeah.
So they migrate a little bit, and then they hit a wall, and they get out. Right. So, right. And we will make sure that they are confined in the center of the storage region so that they don't hit a wall. All right? And this I'll show you a little bit about that. And the ring layout, there are 4 quadruples. I showed you this already. The quadruples, here they are, the electrostatic quadruples. This is the positive and the negative terminals. So it's a quadrupole, all right? The electric field goes from here to there and so on. If your muon tries to go up, this pushes it down. The electric field is proportional to the displacement, so it the force is proportional to that. And this is how a muon sees the ring. Yeah, this is about 10 centimeters between the plates, remember. All right? Yeah, this is how it goes. And they make about 4,000 turns. Beautiful thing. I show you this to get an idea of the size. That is, it's not a pencil beam, and the beam is about 90 millimeters in diameter in the middle of this. All right. But the problem is they make coherent motions horizontally and vertically. But the horizontal motion is the thing that complicates matters a little bit, and in order to make matters even more complicated, there is aliasing. involved. And aliasing produces frequencies. When you measure frequency, what is the last thing you want to see in the data? Another frequency that's very near it, right? And this is what is happening over here. Because you see that this frequency, this aliasing, it just happened to be very close to twice the G-2 frequency. I mean, who would know? This is exactly what is happening. All right, this is the aliasing, about 14 turns. If you try to understand it, it will take too long. Just take it for granted. All right, the frequencies that are there are, this is a G-2, this is a cyclotron frequency, horizontal motion, and this is the vertical motion. But then the difference of the horizontal of the cyclotron and the horizontal motion creates this, which is very near twice this frequency. And that's where the complication starts. And, well, if you do a Fourier analysis of the residuals, you take the data, you feed it with five parameters, and then you Fourier analyze the residuals, you'll get everything that is there. All right, this is twice the G-2 frequency, and this is the difference between the CBO and the G-2, and it shows up. And that line over there, that is, it looks like deceivingly, very in the noise, that influences your G-2 frequency, what you measure. All right? Okay, this is what we had. At the beginning, we didn't know about this. We ran very near the worst place. Just didn't know about it. Now, later on, became smarter, so we got as far as away as possible from them. But it's not a negligible effect, so you have to understand it. Over here in 1999, we thought the systematic error was that. We covered that now. Very quickly, this is, well, it was a little bit higher, all right? And we expect this to go to 40 parts per billion. I mean, this is small numbers you want to measure, all right? That's it. And the way to do that, our student Owen Kim is doing the wonderful work over here. There is RF scraping, and RF meaning about the megahertz, and you want to apply something like 500 volts at 1 megahertz to just shape them, to put them together, to do exactly what they need to do. And just to tell you, to make a long story short, this would be the average position of the muons as a function of time, all right? These muons live 64 microseconds, so we take data for 1,000 microseconds, and you'll see that's how it looks. The average grows, and then it goes back down. And after on applied the new method, then if you fully analyze, this is what you get on the displacement. This is the important thing, by the way, for the detectors. This is not as important. And then what you get is a reduction of that average motion by a big factor. It turns out to be a factor of 10 improvement. Yes, we can do the experiment much better with much less systematic errors and so on. And that is after you fully analyze that, it's really much smaller. It's going to be a beautiful experiment. All right? And a lot of other things we'll do on top of that. We'll even make the shape of the beam just right. For those who know beam dynamics for storage rings, you want to match the beam line into the storage ring admittance. That is, this is the admittance of the ring. This is phase space, by the way. This is the angle. This is the position. And you want to have a store beam that looks like the admittance, just like this, all right? Okay, and the hardware is tested, and next week we are going to Fermilab to make one more test of those that hardware before we install the final installation. Okay, so what we try to do here, reduce the CBO amplitude due to the phase space mismatch between the beam line and the storage ring that could come because the fast kicker may not have enough power to produce that, to produce the correct kick. But also, even if we had the ideal kicker pulse amplitude, the momentum dispersion would create the problems, and we can also fix this. So we can fix all the CBO problem, and then reduce significantly the muon losses without loss of statistics, without losing the muons. One of the things you can do when you have a beam is just swing the beam, hit all the outliers, hit something early on, and then put them back. But you lose your statistics. I mean, it's like throwing the baby with the bathtub. But this way, you save the baby, all right? Remember, muons are very expensive, very expensive. All right, it's the statistics. Just to produce a muon, you have to spend 1 million protons. All right. Okay. So electric dipole moments in magnetic storage rings. Of course, did you know that a relativistic particle in a magnetic storage ring, it actually feels. The presence of 300 megavolts per meter? Did you know? This is a real electric field. Absolutely. All right? So, and we use this to actually probe the electric dipole moment of the muon, because that would tilt the precession plane just a little bit, enough to be able to sense it. And Liverpool built those wonderful trace back systems that can look at the angles and will have a very good run for the electric dipole moment of the muon. This was the old system. The limit from the old system is about 10 to the minus 19 electron centimeters. If everything goes well, we may be able to improve this down to 10 to the minus 21. Yeah, that should be okay.
So there are two different frequencies now, right?
You only probe one, and there is that difference. People say maybe it comes from the electric dipole moment itself, but it would mean too large. But we may be able to improve the electric dipole moment directly by looking at the oscillation of the precession plane, and we can eliminate that possibility. So that is also possible to do now. Okay.
10 minutes.
All right. I'm almost. For the electric dipole moment of the proton, because of the electric dipole moment of the muon, we thought of developing a dedicated electric dipole moment experiment for the muon. But because they are very expensive, we moved into deuterons and then the protons. And it turns out, the sensitivity is just amazing. The whole idea came out of the G minus 2 experiment. So if you take the proton and blow it up to the size of the sun, we'll have a sensitivity to the electric dipole moment along the axis of rotation to 0.1 micrometers. I mean, this is amazing. Absolutely. Why we would do such a thing? Well, we need to explain why we are here anyway. So, and in an electric dipole moment, you probe by applying a very strong electric field. And look at this. Now, did you know the electric dipole moment experiments of the neutrons were done with beams? You can produce a ton of neutrons by taking a proton beam, hitting a target, you produce a sea of neutrons. What is the problem with those neutrons? Most of them, they move. They move. In an electric field, when you move, what do you see? You see a magnetic field. And to minimize the systematic errors, what they do is flip the electric field direction. But at some point, they couldn't control the systematic errors. The velocity distribution of those produced the neutrons, so they had to go to a trap experiment. Those systematic errors were just too much. Well, this proton storage ring EDM experiment is a combination of a beam and a trap. All right? And that's what you do. You do that. And then how can you you do it better, well, at the magic momentum. Remember what we said about the spin? In the horizontal plane, you can fix the spin direction along the momentum, and then just look for the vertical spin precession. That's it, Salavi, right? That would work. That would be a really good experiment. For the electrons, this is 15 MeV over C. If you can find a good way to analyze the spin direction of the electron, that would be a marvelous experiment too. And we developed all of those different things, the magnetic fields, electric and B fields, electric fields itself. The proton is that. There is just too much. I only have 5 minutes. And so we have this actually, developing this as part of the Physics Beyond Colliders at CERN. So this is going extremely well. We had collaboration meeting, one at KAIST, as a matter of fact, and at CERN. This is the one slide I promised about what Andy said, is the following. Well, this is the limit as a function of the force range of these parameters. It's a function of the force range or the axion mass. This comes from the current neutron EDM limit.
I have to say, Yannis, as Eric pointed out yesterday, this should be roughly a factor of three lower, because that is, we made this in 2014 with the bound on the mercury EDM at the time.
The mercury EDM is absolutely a limit on theta QCD, and you're absolutely correct.
Yes.
This should be corrected. When you produce a new slide, I'll use it. So, but
this is from the mercury EDM, even back then.
Definitely. But look at this. This is the Ariadne's projected to reach level, all right? The final one, not the immediate, but the final one. And we are, this is the electroweak CP violating phase at 10 to the minus 16. And we are going to do the final sensitivity of the protons, 10 to the minus 30. We are going to do this experiment. Now, look at this. If Ariadne does the experiment, we do the experiment. Let's say we find it at 10 to the minus 27. Anything can happen, right? It can be 10 to the minus 27. And then Ariadne does the experiment and doesn't find it. Well, the axion is not there. Finally, you can probe the axions in that mass range. Or if you do Ariadne and you find it, you know now the mass of the axion, and you go back and you design a dark matter experiment for that axion mass. So Ariadne is really a master experiment, and we have to do it. All right. And the dark matter, but I have too many slides for the dark matter. How much?
2 or 3 minutes.
2 or 3 minutes, because I don't have much. I can tell you there is a talk, right. A lot of things could be the dark matter and so on, but we do the, because axions could be a lot of them. It's a classical system. What happens is you have everything, the axion field, it just oscillates at one frequency, one very narrow frequency, and we don't know what that frequency is. That's the problem. But if you turn on the magnetic field, the DC magnetic field, you are going to see a small oscillating electric field in that same frequency. And that is the main principle of the experiment. All right? Don't look at this. Okay. I mean, a lot of people are working on this lately. But this is, in red is the microwave cavities, and we are going to do that and then go into open resonators for slightly higher frequencies. And you see in dark is the monopole-dipole interactions. This is the Ariadne. And we do everything that is possible, all right? And let me show you what I mean by that. By the way, if this thing is correct, if axions exist, we are going to produce energy out of nothing. Yes, turn on the magnetic field, produce energy, one frequency and so on. It's not much, yeah. All right? But it will. It will produce, it will modify Maxwell's equations. right. So it's, but the thing is, all right, You are scanning the frequency, and at one frequency, you're going to see more power.
But that's
and
that, not the way those axioms are going
to
be moved.
No, coherently. Coherently. No, this is a little
misleading.
Yeah, a little misleading. It's true. I should change it.
Yes,
yes, yes, yes. Oh, my God. You want to work with us? Well, if you put the cell phone, your cell phone, or our cell phone, our receiver, on Mars, we would still be able to see 4 bars. It's that sensitive, our receiver. All right? But in order to do that, you have to have an ability to scan fast. Let me tell you, there are only 4 parameters, temperature, magnetic field, volume, and quality factor. We are working on all of them, and we are going to give them the run for their lives. Absolutely, we are going for it. We are going, the plan is to gain a factor of 25 million. That's in the Kepler constant, about 70. And we are going to reach all the way down, and I don't have much time, but I can show you maybe a ton of things that are going on at the Institute. This is what we built, a lot of, let me scan, it's all photos and so on, all right? The LVPs, each one of them is 40 tons, so nothing moves. We have 7 of them, and if you want to have a low vibration pad, you come to Korea, beautiful country, and you do your experiment in our institute. This is, we'll have 5 axion dark matter experiments running in parallel, all right? This is a group, a lot of good people. And this already looks like this, many, many dilution refrigerators. It already looks like this. This is a real photo. It's not the Photoshop, all right? things are moving along. A lot of magnets, all right? 12 Tesla, 18 Tesla, 25 Tesla. Just that's the main thing that's going on. A lot, that's the major plan. And the magnetic fields, something that hasn't been done yet for axions. In accelerator physics, it's more demanding to develop magnets useful for accelerators. If one magnet doesn't work in an accelerator, you don't have an accelerator. In our case, if one magnet works, it's enough. Okay, that's the difference, so we are going for it. The niobium titanium, This is a critical current density versus the applied field. And you see for the niobium titanium, it falls off a cliff after 9.5 Tesla. You can't use it after that. That's why you go to niobium tin, and we are actually using these high TC magnets now. So we are actually producing a niobium tin magnet with Oxford. The company and the high TC magnet with Brookhaven National Lab, so and high TC with a Korean company. So we are developing a 12 Tesla, 18 Tesla, 25 Tesla, and so on, and that will be the workhorse for these experiments. All right, this, as I said, about the LHC magnets are done with niobium titanium. 9 Tesla maximum field, but they already built this. Okay, this is they got 16.2 Tesla.
How big is the volume?
It's a larger. Actually, the aperture is larger. Even the aperture.
It's this is 10 by 10 centimeters.
For our case.
For this case or for your case? No, this is what.
These are ring dipoles. What we have is the big magnets, 32 centimeters, 12 Tesla. Yeah, big. you need big, right? But the 25 Tesla is going to be 10 centimeters in a bore diameter, all right? And this is for the prototype. It happened. We did the phase matching. This is done by the young scientists over here. All right, And this is the 18 Tesla magnet developed by, actually under construction. It's to be delivered in August, and by the end of the month, it's going to be delivered. All right, this is the timeline for it. And this is the plan. Okay, the 25 Tesla will be delivered at the end of 2018. Oxford, the same. The Sunam 18 Tesla is going to be delivered by the end of this month, and we already have a 26 Tesla magnet and so on. This has not been funded yet. If you are interested in collaborating and you have some money, we can invest it. But this is the GA gamma gamma versus the mass of the axion, and you see this is the DFSZ, all right? Under very reasonable assumptions, conservative assumptions, actually. The final goal is to go there, all right? This is with open resonators over here. And that's the summary, all right? Muon J minus 2 is online. It will provide a major challenge to the standard model. And what do we do in Korea? Significant improvements in systematic errors. Dark matter is a great mystery and challenge. Is established to answer whether axions are the dark matter of our universe and develop the best hadronic EDM experiments. And we use powerful magnets for that. And within the next 5 years, we'll be answering whether or not axions have anything to do with dark matter. And of course, proton EDM and Ariadne probing axion physics in a unique way. Thank you very much. Yes.
I have a couple of questions. The first was how the theoretical error in the standard calculation of G-2 has improved over the last few years.
I didn't have slides on this, but it has improved, and it looks they've done their part, because we were projecting they will improve it by a factor of two or so, but it looks very good so far. What is happening in the lattice QCD, that's a completely different way of estimating the hadronic correction, and that looks like it's going to it's taken off, and by the time we have the number, they will have a number as well, and that's very exciting. So that theory is there, absolutely. So we need to do our part to produce a solid number.
The other question was more about the experiment. The knowledge of the ability to calibrate the magnetic field and how you know that it's how you maintain that magnetic field over the 7 years you need to.
Right. We are also developing a helium absolute probe now. That's a separate system. And that's going very well. Yes. And that's going extremely well. So that's a separate way. And so the magnetic field seems, again, well under control. Yeah.
Any last questions? Well, let's thank you guys again.